Ladies and gentlemen, Arthur B. Robinson is the president and research professor of the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine. He is a proponent of revolutionizing 21st century medicine with consumer-based diagnostics and the internet. This is so revolutionary that this could be considered a disruptive technology paradigm, but in fact, it's a call to help humankind and people that need quick access to medical diagnostics that are affordable in a way that hasn't been conceived before. It is my honor and my pleasure to welcome Dr. Robinson to It's Rainmaking Time. Welcome, sir.
Hi. I'm happy to be with you.
Talk a little bit about metabolic profiling.
The scientists call it metabolomics now. We started it in the, my colleagues and I founded the field in the 1970s. Then we called it metabolic profiling. In any case, it involves a great technological advance over the things people are familiar with. You give a urine sample or a blood sample to a doctor, and he sends it out, and about 20 things are measured, about the same things have been measured for 50 years. But in fact, technology today makes it possible to measure thousands of substances in your blood and urine and to give you an enormous amount of information back about your health, current, future health. So metabolomics is that. It's the study of the metabolism of human beings based on the measurement of thousands of compounds that keep them alive, that are the mechanism of life. The technological advances in measurement of substances in human urine and blood has paralleled a tremendous advance in computer technology and in human communications. And it's now possible to put two together, not only metabolomics, but all kinds of other technologies for measuring human health, put the two together and to make a seminal advance in human well-being. I might illustrate it in this way. Long ago, people made investments by looking at a ticker tape. Remember, they may have seen pictures of these little glass globes and this little ticker tape, this paper thing shot out, and financiers sat there looking at the ticker tape and trying to figure out how they could optimize their investments. Today, there is, of course, a vast computer network, worldwide communications network, in which thousands and thousands of sources of economic information are available, funneling huge amounts of information to people so that they can optimize their economic well-being. It's made possible by the computers, the internet, and technological advances which enable them to get lots of information about markets. And it is good for people to have the knowledge that will improve their financial well-being. Well, the same sort of revolutionary change between the ticker tape and what we have today in the investment world is possible in the health world. And a person's health is actually more important to him than his money. It is possible now today to get huge amounts of information about your health, and to have the advantages of analysis of this information by people all over the world and communicate with smart people all over the earth, that can help you to interpret your information and guide you. All we need to do is to couple the technology to the internet and make the changes in our medical system that will permit this.
This has, in effect, been around since the 1970s, I read in your PDF introduction. What you're talking about, if I understand it correctly, is the miniaturization of analytical devices, advancing and utilizing computers, where it puts the ability to analyze and diagnose in the, quote, patient's domain. Is that correct or incorrect?
Yes, part of the technology is miniaturization. Miniaturization makes it possible to collect data in real time on the people without going elsewhere. And it also, so technological advance is making possible computer peripherals in which you would monitor your own health. But it also, the whole thing even involves things which are so big that you still have to go somewhere else, like the MRI and CAT scans. So suppose you had a device on your table that looked like a laser printer, but it measured 1,000 things in your breath as you sat at the computer and gave you information about your health. That would be useful. Now, you probably, most people using this, wouldn't be skilled enough to interpret that information, but businesses would spring up all over the world competing to give you the best information about the breath analysis that is being done by your computer as you sit there. Similarly, you might be walking through a shopping center and see a business which had CAT scanners or MRI or an MRI machine, these wonderful machines that can do three-dimensional scanning of human beings. And maybe you'd stop there and give them $50, and they give you back a DVD of your scan, and you'd go home, play that into the Internet, and go out there searching for companies that would interpret it for you and tell you about anything that you needed to know. Right now, of course, your doctor would have to order this scan based on worry about your health so great that you're going to spend the thousands of dollars that it would take. And then the interpretation is just by whatever man in a white coat happens to be standing there. Instead, it should cost $50, and you should have hundreds of options on the Internet to have interpreters who are the best in the world based on their record, which would also be published. So whether it's a miniaturized device measuring your heartbeat in real time or a thing that looks like a laser printer that would sit on your desk and measure your breath as you sat there and tell you things about your metabolism, or large machines from which you would get the information, the main idea is that we have the technology, both computer technology and analytical technology now, to put people in the position of diagnosing and evaluating and manipulating their own health. Previous to this time, this was all as a part of the medical monopoly. But that monopoly now should fall, and the substitution of it will be something much better, in which a tremendous advance in human health would be possible.
It's very much reminds me of all the infrastructure in many industries, aside from the medical industry, reflects the paradigm operating inside it and reflects the investment in the paradigm, which manifests as the structure. And so what you're really talking about is kind of taking back one's power almost and putting the power back in the people who, you know, people, there's even some people who want to get rid of the Hippocratic Oath. Are you aware of that?
Oh, yes.
That they think it is, should be rendered useless or not non-existent. And so there's a lot of people who think it's unnecessary and it doesn't apply anymore.
Yeah, well, the medical profession, you see, is sort of unique. They not only provide a service, but they evaluate their own service. All the diagnostics is in the hands of the people providing the service instead of the people receiving it. Now we can put the evaluation of the service in the hands of the private individual and improve that evaluation a thousandfold. The medical profession should be in the position of competing for therapeutic measures. We have this national debate going on now about whether to nationalize our medical system, which is costing almost 20% of our national economy. But what we're talking about nationalizing is a system that's 50 years out of date and is costing us huge amounts of money because it has all kinds of people associated with it that just aren't needed. So we could reduce the cost of medicine by several fold and increase its quality by 100-fold by just using the technology around us, but that does involve smashing the current paradigm and replacing it with something better.
What do you think about, I mean, even the concept of smashing the existing paradigm is a disruptive, but also received as disruptive. And even if something that's in place that's at a monstrous level in terms of a stronghold and strength, what about running a parallel universe of activity side by side?
Well, that's, of course, what should be done. No one should have the power to diminish anyone's access to current medical care or to diminish their access to future medical care or futuristic methods. That's the way our free market is supposed to work. One man has a product. You can run a separate universe beside him running with a different product, and the people who pay for these products, the people who earn the money to pay for them, decide gradually what they want on the basis of which one is better. So I wouldn't propose tearing down the current medical system, simply changing the laws so that there are no laws against someone doing better, someone running a parallel medical system. And I have no doubt that the current, with technological advances that have taken place, that this paradigm shift would occur. But I don't suggest that it should be occur by edict. You simply want to, there are certain laws which monopolize, which make medicine a monopoly of a certain group. Those monopolistic laws need to be rescinded, and in that case, we just see whether the things I'm saying are right, because the free market would decide.
So, really, with that being what it is, and we know that there is a monopoly in the medical industry and a lockdown, my question to you is, and then I want to get back to the question of quantitative measuring, do you really think that you and I and others live in a free market if you have a lockdown, a complete stronghold and a lockdown on all discovery, new manufacturing, and new technologies that are faster, better, more effective, and cheaper?
Well, no, we don't. We don't have a free market in medicine. We definitely do not.
So the whole concept of a free market economy is great to talk about philosophically, but if you and I really look into the truth about the medical industry and system, it's not in operation at all.
No, that's true. Well, there's a little of it.
Yeah.
Mostly it's not. But it's not philosophical, you know, because the United States, there's a reason why at the time of World War II, the United States produced two-thirds of all the industrial production in the entire world. And it wasn't because Americans were geniuses. It was because they were free. We used to have a much freer system than we do today. And freedom does these things. People can do things, and then they can compete. But in medicine today, we have a very monopolistic system. You can't even, I mean, an ordinary pet dog has more, and his owner, have more freedom of medical, more medical freedom than a human being. Because veterinarians are not as restricted by the government in the things they do than our physicians. A physician cannot even do many things a veterinarian can do, not because they're not good, but because the medical monopoly won't permit it.
In order to make, we're going to shift gears here because we both know and other people know very well what is occurring. In order to make significant progress in preventative diagnostic and therapeutic medicine, and these are your words, it's necessary to have quantitative measurement of human health. Explain that to the public.
Well, suppose that we pose a simple question. This is the question that we posed, Linus Pauling and I posed in 1968, that led us to invent metabolomics. We wanted to know how much vitamin C or vitamin B6 or vitamin B3 a person should eat for optimum health. Well, we could reduce that to a simple graph. Suppose you have a graph, and on the vertical axis you have health, quantitatively measured, and on the horizontal axis you have the amount of vitamin C someone should be eating. All right, the graph would start in the origin. There would be zero health with no vitamin C because it's required for life. And then as you ate more and more vitamin C, your health would rise, the graph would rise, until it reached a maximum. And then it would start down because you would be eating too much vitamin C, more than was good for you. We wanted to know how to draw that graph so that we could tell an individual how much vitamin C he should eat. But the graph cannot be drawn unless we can quantitatively measure his health. Now this is a simple explanation, one substance, one simple graph, but it affects everything. If you're sick, it affects how much drug you're taking. If you are not ill, but if your health, the probability, if you could measure your health quantitatively, the process of doing that would really give you the probabilities of disease. In other words, suppose that the measurements showed that your probability of having a heart attack was three times greater than normal. Well, if you can measure that probability, then you can change things about your life, whether it's exercise or what you eat or any other thing that you hear might help you. And if you can measure that probability, you can fight the probability of disease rather than disease itself. That's preventive medicine. Today, preventive medicine works without the tools of measurement. In other words, you hear that if you eat more vitamin E, you'd live longer. Or if you would exercise more, you'll live longer and be better health. And all kinds of advice, you know, magazines are full of it. There's a vast amount of advice about what you might do to optimize your health, but no way to measure your health so that you can see how these things affect you. Many things are claimed to make you live longer. If you do this, you'd live longer, that, you'd live longer, and so on. Well, if you have a way of quantitatively measuring your physiological age, you can simply make a graph on your computer of your rate of aging, and when you make a change in your lifestyle, you can see whether that increases or decreases the slope of that graph.
That sounds exciting.
Quantitatively, measuring the probability of the illness quantitatively, measuring the rate of physiological aging quantitatively, makes it possible for a human being to make a graph of those important parameters with respect to the way he lives. And once he can make those graphs, he can optimize his life.
What are these metabolites that are so important that are the basis of a lot of what you're talking about?
Well, you realize in a living thing, human being, for example, the DNA is simply a library of how to make proteins. The proteins do everything, from the form the structural materials of your body to catalyzing all the chemical reactions required to keep you alive, to burn your food, to enable you to see, think, hear, and so forth. There are about 30,000 different kinds of proteins in your body doing all these things.
That's a lot of action.
But those proteins, of course, there are more than 30,000 protein molecules, 30,000 different types. Now, these proteins mostly catalyze chemical reactions. They cause the reactions needed for your life to take place rather than reactions that wouldn't be useful for your life. Most of those reactions involve small molecules, molecules with molecular weights, say, under 500. And those are metabolites. They are the result of metabolism, which is the combined chemical reactions taking place and being catalyzed by all of these protein molecules. So in order to stay alive, you need to have thousands of different small molecules made inside your body where they're needed so that they can burn your food, enable you to walk, talk, think, do all the things you do. Protein molecules are busy making all of those things and adjusting the amounts so that you will be alive. The DNA is sitting there just telling the body how to make the protein molecules. But the essence of life is all of these substances that the proteins are making for you. And these are called metabolites because metabolism is the combined efforts of all these protein molecules to fill your cells with the small molecules that you need to stay alive.
So why do you think it is that there's so much focus now on all this DNA extraction, the Human Genome Project sequencing DNA?
One, it was easy. Technology was developed to sequence DNA, and there are only only a four-letter code, and so it was easy to measure the genome. The other reason is that it became popular. You realize science is no longer funded by free enterprise. For the most part, it's funded by government grants. It became very popular to work on DNA, so a large part of government funding for biochemistry was put into DNA research, and this caused this particular aspect of biochemistry to shoot ahead of the others just because there was money to work on it.
I think also
it was a fairly easy problem. The DNA is not very complicated. It's an easy problem compared to metabolomics or protein chemistry.
Also, in law enforcement, I understand there's an evolution and a serious interest to look into DNA matching.
Yeah, well,
and to start to DNA everything in sight. There's, of course, grave concerns of mine and other people about about the misuse of that ability. But I think that in the current Homeland Security, law enforcement, police overseeing things, alteration in technology, tasers, RFID chipping, and this whole kind of electronic surveillance society. The locking in on the DNA, I find, is a part of that apparatus, although it's not pertinent necessarily to this conversation on a medical level. But I was wondering, in something you said about the Human Genome Project, you said if you have a leak in your house, it's not in the design drawing of your house. And you were comparing that with there's information in DNA and proteins, but there's more. You're going to get a greater amount by looking at metabolites. Did I say that correctly?
Yeah, pretty close. Firstly, don't think that I'm diminishing the value of learning about the structures, the codes in the DNA. It was quite valuable, and it was done by free enterprise, actually. There was a multi-billion-dollar government effort, but it was totally wiped out by one man and a $100 million company that did the job instead. But, no, what you're commenting on are my comments about the information content of various subsections of molecules in a human being with respect to what they can do about their health.
Right.
You can't do anything about your DNA. It's what it is. Now, maybe in some Star Trek future, we will be able to change our genetic material, but that's not now. No one living now will see any significant advances of that kind. The design of your house is not what matters. If it's raining and the roof is leaking, you don't rush to the architectural drawings to figure out what about the design allowed the roof to leak. You have to go up and see where the hole is and patch it. So the protein molecules and the metabolites, manipulating the amounts of the things that the proteins make, that's the functional information about your house, and those are the things you can change by diet and by lots of other ways in which you can benignly interfere with the way your life is going. You can patch the roof in your house if you have the tools to go up, find the hole, fix it, and then go down below and see if it's still leaking. So DNA has less information in it that was helpful to someone in improving their health than do the protein molecules, and the metabolites have more information than the protein molecules themselves, because they are the things that are actually, that's where the action is. You could say, well, there's a vast economic system out there, and its design is interesting. The big people who manipulate it, the proteins, are also interesting, but what really matters to me is how much money's in my pocket, and those are the metabolites.
That's interesting. What is your take on the mitochondria role then?
Well, mitochondria are one of the structures that are important in cells. They perform very important structures, and there's a lot of metabolism in the mitochondria. They really are part of metabolism. That's where metabolize. We get the energy to live, and there are mitochondria are made up of a lot of proteins that are able to take metabolites, which we obtain from eating our food. We eat our food. The food is digested into small molecules, which we would call metabolites. Those are transported through our blood and diffusion into the cells. The mitochondria in the cells, which are made up of proteins, take those metabolites and convert them into other metabolites, which provide the energy for us to stay alive. So mitochondria is a little factory made of proteins that converts some metabolites into other metabolites and takes some energy out during the conversion and gives it to us to live.
What is the discovery and the work that you're doing and your institute is doing with regard to a molecular clock for aging? I found that fascinating.
Well, this is fundamental biochemistry, and what we work on, our particular field of specialization, involves two of the 20 amino acids of which proteins are constructed. These amino acids, particularly one of them, change with time after the molecule is made. And the change that occurs causes a charge to occur on the protein when the change takes place. These are in all proteins, and long ago, in the early 70s, we worked on out this hypothesis that they serve as clocks. Every protein has some of these clocks built into it. These clocks decide how long the molecule will be there before it is replaced by a new one. They decide how the molecule changes into a different protein molecule, and that the change has consequences for the living thing. They're clocks. So you can make these clocks run anywhere from with a half-life of a few hours to centuries based on how you build the protein molecule. And, of course, the DNA decides how that will be built. So we work on these clocks, work on how to figure out how fast they run and how they time biological processes.
Fascinating.
Because we believe they time most biological processes. These experiments are difficult. It is known that they time some biological processes, and the rest is yet unknown.
Most of your work now, or all of your work now, is privately funded, correct?
That's correct. We don't seek or accept any government funding.
That's a pretty unusual stand to take, isn't it?
It leaves us free to do what we think is best, and that's a freedom that most of our colleagues don't have.
How were you able to move from making a commitment to that to actualizing it? What do you think it took for you to get going on this? Most people are afraid to leave the government funding apparatus.
Well, this is something that I learned a lot about in the old days because Linus and I built an institute with this objective and succeeded in making the transition. First, you have to become very frugal about the way you spend money because you're asking the people who earned the money for it rather than a government agency made up of people who didn't earn it. So you reduce your efforts to those which you think are most important, and you pay a lot of attention to what you're doing so that with fewer resources than you would have on government grants, you're able to accomplish more.
It's an optimization, isn't it, of all your efforts?
You have to be efficient because you're spending someone else's money and they're watching you because you're asking them for it. The second thing that helps is to have already a reputation in science and have done work in science that people will think is of value. So in the case of the institute we built long ago that Linus and I built and this one, we benefited from the fact that over the years, my colleagues and I had done work which we could show to people saying, here we accomplished this, we can accomplish the next thing. And it's very hard for someone starting out to do this. They'd really have to go to work for somebody who is doing it. It's difficult. The third thing that makes difficult today, of course, is the government is now taking so much money from the private sector and in taxes that there isn't as much money there for this. So if all scientists were to suddenly decide to raise their money in the private sector and taxation wasn't changed, there wouldn't be money there for them. Only a few scientists can do this because the resources aren't there because they've been taken by government. So these are all things that are part of it. But basically, you have to have already accomplished something. It's kind of a bootstraps thing because you have to have something to show people that you've done. So it's easier for an older scientist working with new scientists to do it. And then you have to be pretty careful about the way you spend the money in terms of optimizing everything. If we were sitting in a university doing the kind of work we're doing, we'd have millions of dollars in government grants. Then you don't worry too much about what you're doing because you just the money just comes. But if you're asking people that earn the money to help you, then you have to be a lot more careful about what you do. We're not a very big place, but we do good work.
Do you have a certain time frame, or does a scientist work with a time frame for getting results very much the way business people feel a pressure to get the results? Like, do you feel pressure?
That depends on what he's doing.
Yeah.
He shouldn't. Right now, the time frame of most scientists is very short, and it harms them. The government granting system, requires constant reporting, constant competing for the next year's money, and so forth and so on. So scientists tend to publish almost monthly. they publish and publish and publish because the grant requests have to show a big, long line of publications. And I would say it's conservative to say that half the money of all the senior scientists, half the time of all the senior scientists in the country, it goes into generating publications and making reports that are all premature because you just don't make discoveries every day. An interesting comment was made by a few years ago by a man who won the Nobel Prize in chemistry. His father had won the Nobel Prize in chemistry earlier, and they said, "What had made it possible for you to do this? How'd you manage? Was it easier because your father got a Nobel Prize?" And he says, "Well, the big thing was that because of my father's Nobel Prize, I was able to work for 5 years with nobody bothering me and get the job done." So, most scientists work under such short time frame intervals in order to make all these reports to the bureaucrats that are telling them what to do, that it makes it difficult. It's better, in most cases, the great advances in science of the past have mostly been made by men and women who fell in love with the subject, lived and breathed that subject for years until they understood it thoroughly, and then made some important discovery as a result of that devotion to the problem. So scientists really should work in a relatively free environment where they're free to work for years because it's not easy to discover new things. Putting them under pressure doesn't really help, but actually hurts them. And one of the ways our current scientists are hurt is that they're under enormous pressure, and that leads to all kinds of problems.
Where are you at, and are you able to share how it's going for you right now with regard to the discovery of a molecular clock, and what are the positive life-giving ramifications as that discovery unfolds?
Well, we work on both. In molecular clocks, the biochemistry is going very well. We wrote a book about this. We've written a lot of good papers. It's a wonderful field to be in, and we're doing quite well. In terms of direct application, we just published a paper on the molecular clocks and the protein that is most implicated in Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's.
My mother had Alzheimer's and died last year.
I'm not telling you we cured Alzheimer's.
Right.
But there's a protein, alpha-synuclein, which is found in large amounts precipitated in the brains of the victims of these two diseases. And no one knows why it's present in large amounts in precipitated form, but there's so much of it there that it is impeding mental function. It may be symptomatic of what causes these diseases, or
right.
It may be a primary part of the cause. There's lots that's not known, but it is known this protein is a seminal part of these two diseases. Well, it took us about a year, and we learned all that was needed to be known about the molecular clock is running clocks, two of them, that are running inside this protein. And when we published it, that told the protein chemists all over the world that are working with it something new about the molecules they're working with. And it may, in fact, have value for them because we now know a little more about that protein than we did. So you see, we were working on our molecular clocks, but we chose a protein to do the work on that had medical
implications.
So you don't. The best thing you can do is to have scientists, if they can, to work on something that is of scientific value, fundamental value, but also has some value to the people who are paying for the work.
I have something interesting to share with you about the molecular structure of something that took me by surprise a year ago. There's something called birch tree sugar that is explained as being very different as it metabolizes in our bodies on a molecular level, such that diabetics can use it. It's not like regular sugar. And when I heard that, I thought it was fascinating. And I'm wondering if you could explain, A, what a molecule is, even though it's late in the conversation, and how that could be so.
Well, I don't know anything specific about the sugar you mentioned, but a sugar is a class of molecule. There are thousands of kinds of sugars. Sugar means to an organic chemist a certain particular kind of molecule. Sugar molecules usually have a ring, and the rings aren't always in ring form, but one way they're drawn and they exist in a ring form, there's a ring of five or six carbon atoms, and then hydrogen atoms and hydroxyls are, and hydroxyl molecules are stuck on the sides of them. The molecules have molecular weight of 300 or 400. They're metabolites. And your body contains a lot of different kinds of sugars. Now, the sugar that we, the table sugar that we eat is a dimer of two sugars, glucose and fructose. First thing that happens when you eat it is that your body hydrolyzes it in the stomach and it's turned into fructose and glucose. And then those are further used or metabolized in your body. So these are small molecules. Sugars are metabolites. Virtually all the naturally occurring sugars are metabolites of either plants or animals. And diabetics have trouble metabolizing the sugar that is normally present in food, so they need help. It wouldn't be surprising to me that there's a sugar that they could metabolize, and that seems to be what you're talking about, but I don't have any special knowledge about that sugar.
Right. And the other question I had for you about this metabolic clock is, if this exists vis-a-vis your research, could we say that the molecular clocks, by virtue of the fact that they're there, make molecules almost intelligent? Does that make sense?
I'm very sorry. Would you repeat that? Because
sure.
The beam went on behind me for a minute.
Sure, no problem. In other words, because a molecular clock has been discovered and is functional, could it be said also then that molecules are intelligent or have an intelligence in them?
No, I don't think so. What we would call intelligence, would be, you could say that if you were trying to get attention with your book, but with a book you were writing, but I don't think there's much.
But what would you refer to it as? Because obviously there's some type of like, in other words, it's more intricate than we thought, and it's more active.
I build a machine.
Yeah.
Suppose I want this machine. Well, I've got it. So you got to water, watering your lawn, and you got a timer in the back with a clock in it that decides when the lawn will be watered. This clock regulates the water system. Now, that's a clock. It doesn't mean intelligence, but it just does things when it's scheduled to do them. One of the clocks, one of the ways in which the reaction, my son and I worked together on this, and he worked out a way for calculating the rate at which these clocks would run in proteins when the three-dimensional structure of the protein was known. This was greatly helpful to an advance that was made at Washington University in St. Louis. They found that when the DNA in a cell was damaged by radiation or some other thing, one of these clocks that we study started running. And the clock had about a 24-hour time span on it. If the clock ran out, the cell was killed. If the DNA was repaired properly before the time ran out, then the clock was reset and the cell continued to live.
That's fascinating.
This was a little clock built in there to time the DNA repair mechanisms, and if they were too slow to kill the cell so you wouldn't have a defective cell around, and the clock was one of these clocks we work on that was built into a protein. And because of our work, the scientists working on it could know how fast their clock was running. So this is a timed process. You could say the molecule was a little more intelligent because it had a timer in it. I think the word intelligence might be a little high-flown for a clock.
I totally understand. I read about the fact that you lost your wife when she was not able to get into the hospital, and how you didn't have any type of these miniature devices to check what was going on. Can you explain that? And I'm very sorry about the loss of your wife, but share it.
Wasn't actually, she couldn't. My wife, Laura Lee, was a computer systems programmer, and she did all of the computer work connected with the metabolic profiling over an 8-year period that we did. She was a fabulous computer programmer, so we worked together. And we also had 6 children. At the time she died, they were ages 1.5 to 12.
Wow.
The reason I mentioned her in an article, which I think you're referring to, because she was the first computer programmer to ever work on metabolic profiling, and she made possible many of the discoveries in this field because of her computer work. And yet the simplest molecular profiling device could have easily saved her life. She got a very rare condition, caused her pain one day, and she died that night. If the advances that I'm talking about, which her work helped to make possible and which could already have been in place if we hadn't had the inertia of the medical system, any one of the simplest devices that we devised could have told her what was wrong with her and she'd have gone to the hospital. But she didn't go. She didn't know how sick she was. So she didn't have access to a surgeon who could have saved her life because she thought she just had a bad stomachache. In fact, she had a fatal disease. So pancreatitis. So in that case, a home-based diagnostic system, or even a medical system which is easy to access, would have saved this woman's life. Instead, she died because it was not known that she needed to be hospitalized. She had a bad stomachache. I said to her in the evening, "You want me to take you to the hospital?" And she says, "No, let's see how I feel in the morning." You realize all the decisions that go in. The emergency room was an hour and a half away. They keep a sick lady who didn't feel good up for several hours, charge her $1,000, and she didn't know she was seriously ill. If she'd had something on her desktop that for, 50 cents worth of materials would have told her she was seriously ill, then she'd have gone. That's what the story is. She died because she didn't know something about her health that technology could have told her, but that technology is not there because the older medical paradigm really prevents it from being implemented.
How far along are you and the Institute right now before we can have some test devices with people who are interested in being part of what you're doing?
The problem, pardon me a second, it's a telephone. Hopefully it'll stop. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay. The Institute, we do research. We publish papers. We do things to show how things can be done and to make discoveries to the extent we can. But we don't have the resources to apply these things. We can't go out and build an industry. That requires resources far beyond those that we have available. So although we can do an experiment, and we even did in the 70s, we've done experiments showing, for example, the procedures I was mentioning were diagnostic of many diseases. But it takes a lot of resources to bring these procedures to people in general. It requires industry. Those industries must be built. They must be capitalized. They must build equipment. They must serve large numbers of people so that they can drive the cost of that equipment down to low enough levels that they're available to everyone. They're major industrial activities. And in many ways, these industrial activities are already difficult to do in our country because of the changes that have occurred in our political system. We, for example, have a terrible shortage of energy today, and yet we were once the leading technology country in the world in the production of energy. The reason for that is simply that certain kinds of energy production were, by taxation, regulation, and litigation, pushed out of our country. So industries would need to be built to apply these things. And it's not clear that they could be built in America today because we lack the capital and we have this huge burden of government on our backs that really prevents anyone from doing much of anything new. It's hard to even keep doing what you're doing.
Where in the world? Where in the world are you familiar with where there's more of a free hand at discovery and development and exploration that can be enabled to move into manufacturing with speed and precision quickly?
Well, that's a hard question, and I'm no expert in it. But I noticed, for example, I heard on the radio the other day that there's an insurance company in the United States that is offering. Are getting ready to offer insurance at much lower rates, medical insurance. But the deal is they pay your transportation to Brazil, where they're operating hospitals at a third the American cost. maybe Brazil is such a place. India, a lot of people are going to India for ordinary medical care. All the way to India they go because it's cheaper and they can get good care. I think probably in some of these less developed countries where there's more interest in developing industry than there is in taxing it and living on it, are probably better, although I don't know that because the grass is always greener somewhere else.
Sure. What do you think of Mexico? A lot of people
I don't know. I absolutely have no special knowledge about these things. I do know, I know one very fine doctor who's a specialist in an important procedure, who was forced out of the United States, and he works in Mexico. And I'm not saying that I sign on to everything that's done over the border. This was a very remarkable man. He went to Mexico, and he was able to practice his profession in Mexico, but not in the United States. On the other hand, it is a underdeveloped country, and although he was able to practice his profession, he was not able to build an institution there that enabled him to expand that practice around the world. He existed, and he was able to work without being arrested, but he was not able to do much more. And when it's fine to have a hero. It's fine to say, oh, that man is a wonderful thing. Isn't it wonderful he can do this wonderful thing? But if it isn't delivered to the hundreds of millions of people in the world who would like to have access to it, then there's a failure. So you have to talk about where in the world could you do the work, and you also have to have a balance between that and places where there's enough capital to and enough free enterprise to expand what you're doing to cover a lot of people. Probably the larger countries that are less developed and have less governmental impediments, which are probably today places like Brazil and India, even it's a terrible paradox. You know, China is a communist country, but we have our industries leaving in tremendous numbers to China because it's actually a better place to do business than it is the United States.
I was just talking with Jim Rogers about that, about his book, A Bull in China.
There's one thing that might interest you. I've read this in magazines. I don't have firsthand knowledge on the numbers, but I've read that as much as 80% of the principal figures in the Chinese government are engineers and scientists.
That's amazing.
In the United States, you know that most of the principal figures in our government are lawyers.
That doesn't surprise me.
But you see, engineers and scientists, they're not superhuman. It doesn't mean they won't make mistakes. They're less like, the least understand what they're doing, whereas these lawyers understand something else, and haven't been doing too well for us.
So it may be that the paradigm in which a breakthrough in the revolutionizing of 21st century medicine with consumer-based diagnostics and the internet may begin to manifest with the provision for a totally new construct of legal standing. And that with the new structure of legal standing comes the pouring out of a totally new medical industrial complex that is being enabled to do exactly what you're suggesting should be done.
Yeah, well, like most things, most great, and I'm not saying that we've done some great thing, but the technological advance of the world has gotten to the point where this particular great thing can be done. And most of these great advances have been made by free people. And really, it's the question, where's the greatest freedom to do this? The American people are now involved in a tremendous debate about whether they will become a socialist country or move back to becoming a free country. And it's possible that they will throw off socialism and move back toward freedom. If they do, this would be a fine place for these advances to take place. If they don't, if they continue down the socialist road which they've been going and which is accelerating, then America will not be a place where these advances can take place, but we hope that other places in the world will be more free, and they will.
Is there any other part of your work that you're very excited about that you'd like to share with audiences on the who are listening to the show?
Well, I know there are all sorts of details, but the molecular clocks and the work on metabolic profiling and quantitative measurement of health have been the things that have fascinated us the most. We also work on some issues that don't seem related, like homeschooling. And
I noticed you have a whole site on homeschooling.
Yeah, well, what happened was that when my wife died, we moved here to Oregon and set up our own research institute. We're happily going along. When she died, I had six small children, and she'd been homeschooling them. And, of course, we'd lost our teacher, and I didn't have time to. So we, over the years, the children and I worked out a very good method whereby homeschooled children can teach themselves without a teacher.
And that's another paradigm shift, isn't it?
And that has worked out remarkably well, and now the kids started a little business selling CDs with their system on it, and now they have 60,000 students.
That's amazing. Are they all from the U.S.?
Mostly.
There's
some in foreign countries, mostly in the U.S., and the curriculum's only English, so it's English speakers abroad that use it if they do. Mostly U.S. and Canada. Our school systems have deteriorated badly, and it, which is a tragedy, and about 2% of the kids in the United States now are homeschooled, but with this curriculum, it's not the only homeschool curriculum, of course, but it seems it has special merit, and with it, the three of my six children went through college in 2 years for their science degrees.
That's amazing.
Based on having done this, and they've done very well in graduate school as well. Three of them are finished with graduate school.
And I hear one of them went to Caltech.
Yeah, Noah, the scientist I work with all the time. Noah and I work together all the time.
And he was homeschooled?
Oh, yes. He went through college in 2 years, and he got his PhD at Caltech in three.
See, I have to tell you that just this is me speaking. I'm not speaking for anybody, but I've grown up with a lot of prejudice and ignorance about homeschooling.
Uh-huh.
And I grew up thinking of it as fringe. And I'm just being honest with you. I hope you're not insulted, but I grew up with the perception of it being fringe, not realistic.
Oh.
I'm just telling you, and not good for the children, because they don't have access to being socialized and dealing with conflicts and resolving things with other kids. And I had a lot of beliefs about it, and I've just recently become open to that whole arena, and even maybe would like to do a separate show on it. I really think it deserves its own.
Well, perhaps, that'd be fine.
Its own focus, but I thought it would be interesting for you to share.
some of these images are quite false, you know. Just because you're homeschooled doesn't mean you're not around other children. The idea of socialization was really a sort of a red herring directed against homeschooling. And then, of course, the homeschoolers would say that the socialization they do have in the bosom of their own families is perhaps superior to what we offer in the public schools today.
Yeah, I'm just sharing with you my prejudices, because I'm sure that there's people out there, you know, I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying recognized that I have it. You know?
Academics is overwhelming. It's amazing. These studies have been done over and over and over. Where on standardized tests and math and all of the other subjects, results are about the same. Where the performance of the public school students is are at about 57th percentile, and black and Spanish American students are at about 25th percentile.
Is that in recent statistics?
Those are recent statistics. But in homeschooling, it's different. The average performance, based on the same scale, is 80th percentile for all three races. There's no difference.
That's stupefying.
I have a lot of black homeschooling mothers that call me, and these are tough ladies. I think they may be better than the average, but the you see this tremendous difference. Academic performance is much greater among the homeschoolers, and the differences we see, the racial differences we see, which have been partially tearing our country apart, are just not there. In fact, if the situation was reversed, homeschooling would, of course, be outlawed as child abuse.
I hear what you're saying. So it's very interesting.
It's an important movement, I think. Only 2% of the children are homeschooled now. They're not having no trouble getting into universities because universities are beginning to see that they generally have, on average, better academic performance.
Was there ever a time?
Family, it's been a wonderful blessing. The children have done very well.
Was there ever a time when it was very difficult when a child was homeschooled to get into high school or college?
I don't know. It's certainly not during our time. It may have been. Well, of course, if you go back, we started homeschooling in the mid-1970s. And before that, and sort of ending at that time, there were lots of, there were quite a few parents who went to jail for doing this because there was a whole period of time in which it had to become legal to school your children, and these battles were fought out state by state.
Is it legal? Is it legal?
It's harder to get into college because in many cases it was illegal to do.
Is it legal now in all 52 states?
Yes. There are occasional little efforts by the public school people to make it illegal again, but they never get anywhere. There was an effort a couple of years ago in California, but it failed. It's legal everywhere, and it's very rare. I notice on the internet, on a site that looks for things that would irritate conservatives, they occasionally have some family that is being suppressed from homeschooling, but if you read the article, it's usually in Germany, not in the United States. So really, it's legal everywhere. Parents sometimes get into trouble with local authorities because, as people, we're troublesome, and sometimes we get in arguments, but mostly it's legal throughout the country.
Did you write any books about this?
What'd you say?
Did you write a book about homeschooling?
No, I wrote a small book, which is on our curriculum, about how to do it.
Where is it? What website is it on?
Well, that's not there. It's in the curriculum.
Okay.
Want, I'll send you a curriculum. You can read it.
Well, just for audiences, if you want anybody to order.
We have a website, robinsoncurriculum.com. It's actually not ours. It's a friend that runs the website, and he sells the curriculum, and it has a lot of information.
It's called Robinson Curriculum?
Robinsoncurriculum.com.
.com.
And I'm not, of course, I think this is a wonderful curriculum, and a lot of people use it, but I'm not implying that we are the homeschool movement.
I hear you. No, I understand. And what about for molecular clocks for aging? Is there anything written or on metabolites?
We wrote a book on that. Robinson molecular clocks, and it's the standard reference text in this field.
Is it mostly for scientists?
Find it on Amazon.com. Robinson and Robinson molecular clocks, or you can go to this is a big word, deamidation.org on the internet. I'll spell it, and there you can see the book for nothing if you want. It's completely readable there. Deamidation, D-E-A-M-I-D-A-T-I-O-N, deamidation.org.
What does that mean?
Deamidation is the chemical reaction involved in the molecular clock.
Does one have to be a scientist to understand it?
If you read the Molecular Clocks book, you would get the general idea and probably understand about 25% of the book if you had no scientific training.
How about that PDF that you sent me called Revolutionizing 21st Century?
Well, that's for the general public. Anyone should understand that.
And how do people get that? They go to your website. What is your institute?
Well, you saw that. Let's see. I don't know whether we have this.
Well, what is your website for your institute, first of all?
OISM.org. Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine, OISM.org.
Okay.
The this article was published in the Journal of the American Physicians and Surgeons, and it is on the Internet on their site.
Okay.
And you have the reference there on
sure.
The copy. And then I gave a talk on it at George Gilder's symposium, which I think you saw, and that's on the Internet.
Do you want to share anything about your work with Linus Pauling?
Well, I will if you want me to.
Oh, well, whatever you feel like sharing. I mean, a lot of people...
Well, Linus and I had a famous fight, so people focus on that. But I went to Caltech as an undergraduate, and I could express it this way. I was sitting in freshman chemistry, and my best friend looked at me, and he says, "I don't know what's more fun, watching Pauling or watching you watch Pauling." He was a great teacher and a great chemist. I idolized him, and he became a close friend. I became almost family because my parents died while I was in graduate school, and so the Pauling family was largely my family. We worked together for 15 years. He was an outstanding scientist, and we did a lot of good work together. We founded an institute. The institute was sort of destroyed when we got in a fight. The name is now used at Oregon State University, where they're building something in his name. It's a sort of different organization. We got in a serious argument over vitamin C. And the reason was that Linus became more and more enamored with vitamin C, and he made quite a few public claims about its benefits, that it does have some benefits. But I was directing our lab then. We founded an institute which had one name. It was changed later to Linus Pauling Institute. I was president and research director, and Linus was chairman of the board. Anyway, I was working along there, and I wanted to know about the growth rate of cancer as a function of intake of vitamin C. So I set up a lab with two technicians, and we were studying growth rate of a particular kind of cancer in 1,000 mice. And the general results of the work were that there were 40 experiments, were that anything that improves the nutrition of the mice increases the growth rate of the cancer. If you want to diminish, and this is really a remarkable finding, it turned out that you could vary the growth rate of this cancer in mice over a range of 20-fold by diet alone. But the dietary changes were all those that made the diet less efficient. In other words, the cancer needed good nutrition even more than the normal tissues, so that if you partially starved the mice, you starved the cancer more and diminished its growth rate. Well, this went along fine, except the dose-response curve on vitamin C. If you gave the mice more vitamin C, the cancer grew faster. If you kept giving it to them, it reached a kind of a maximum and then started down. But the finding that vitamin C had doubled the cancer growth rate in these mice was something that Linus didn't want to accept. So we got in a fight and stopped working together.
Was it painful?
Well, yeah, we had quite a fight. And it was painful because a lot of our research was destroyed. But that's a negative part of the story.
This is actually very common. Was he your mentor at first?
Was Pauling?
Yes.
Oh, surely. I took chemistry from him as an undergraduate, and then worked with him in research at Caltech while I was a student.
This is a very common phenomenon amongst mentors and mentees.
It's too bad, because older scientists have a lot to offer, but it's different. They start to slow down in terms of the speed of their thoughts, but they have lots of experience.
Yes.
And I think many people made different hypotheses about the fight that Linus and I had. But some of them said, well, Linus just can't accept the younger man because his brain goes faster, but he doesn't have the experience. Together, we were a really good team.
Right.
But the younger man, and then there are all kinds, well, this isn't the reason we had our fight, but I remember once I was sitting in San Diego, and a famous Japanese scientist was working in the laboratory that night, and I was a graduate student. My advisor was Martin Kamen, who discovered carbon-14, a famous scientist. And Martin had suggested that I get busy and get something done in a short time frame, and I had designed some grandiose thing that would take a lot longer. And I mentioned this to this Japanese scientist, and he says, young man, plan long experiment. Old man, plan short experiment.
That's very good.
And this is, in effect, this is a factor, too. The things that Linus and I were doing, some of them, like this profiling and so forth, were very long-term things. They could have great effects, but Linus knew he'd never live to see them. And I'm not suggesting what motivated it. I'm not trying to get inside his mind, but as you get older, you think differently, and though you have a lot to contribute to the younger person who's perhaps mentored, the two of you start to have somewhat different goals.
I totally understand that.
There was, in fact, the extreme of this is a book I had to read in the humanities department at Caltech when I was an undergraduate, The Death of Ivan Illich, by a Russian author. And the theme of the book, Ivan is dying, and everybody is coming around telling him, oh, no, you're not going to die, and so forth. But the basic theme is that Ian lives in an entirely different world. He's dying and the others aren't.
That's very funny.
And
probably not to him.
These scientists, while not dying, you become different. And then, of course, Linus wasn't just a fight between the two of us. He was unfortunate in that he had a son and a couple of other people who were kind of using him and trying to stoke this thing, and probably susceptible to arguments that here you're about to do a wonderful thing on vitamin C, and this Robinson is not enthusiastic enough about it, you see. And an older man trying to say, gee, I don't know whether I'll be here next year, but I got this great, great contribution to make, may be more susceptible to making personal errors because of the time frame he looks at. I'm just talking. This is not about telling you I got inside Linus's mind.
No, I understand.
But we had a fight, and that ended productive work at the Institute we founded, and lost a lot of research, which was a tragedy. But he was one of the greatest chemists of his age, and a very fine teacher, and I enjoyed working with him for 15 years.
You said that you had an associate and a good friend who was the person who discovered carbon-14.
That was Martin Kamen. Yeah, he was my mentor for 30 years.
Wow. What is carbon-14?
Well, carbon-14 is an isotope of carbon. You know, each element has a fixed number of neutrons that determines the number of electrons that are in the atoms of the element, but differing amounts of neutrons, so the elements can weigh different amounts and have different properties and still be chemically similar. So carbon, there's a carbon 12 is the common one. 12 means the atomic weight of the carbon. If it has an extra neutron, it's carbon 13. If it has two extra neutrons, it's carbon 14. Carbon 14 was extremely important. Kamen worked for E.O. Lawrence, and Lawrence gave him the job of looking for a long-lived isotope of carbon, and Kamen found it. It revolutionized biochemistry because it is radioactive but has a very long half-life, so that it became possible to label the carbon atoms on the metabolites, mostly metabolites, in living things. So if you were eating sugar, for example, it was possible to make the sugar with a carbon-14 atom in place of one of the carbon-12 atoms on the sugar molecule. Then if you fed it to an animal, you could watch which metabolites that carbon-14 atom showed up in because it was radioactive and you could measure it. And this is called radioactive tracer research. And virtually everything we know about fundamental biochemistry was learned with tracers, where you could label an atom because you could label it with an isotope that was radioactive, and therefore you could watch it move through metabolism. Now, today we have advanced mass spectrometers that can follow atoms that are not radioactive, so biochemistry continues to advance by labeling the atoms and watching where they go in metabolism, but it uses both radioactive atoms and non-radioactive atoms. The carbon-14, because carbon is the most important element in biological molecules, carbon-14 made it possible to do tracer work, and that caused the explosion that we now know of as modern biochemistry.
Without
going, was fortunate to discover the element.
Without going into a whole other segment related to carbon, can you explain to me what carbon dioxide or CO2 is? And is
it's a dimer. It's a molecule. Carbon dioxide is it has two oxygen atoms and a carbon. A carbon atom with an oxygen atom bound to each side of it is carbon dioxide. It is one of the three most important molecules that makes life possible: water, oxygen, and carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is the source of all carbon in all living things. It is inhaled by plants, and plants use it to build all of their tissues, and then animals eat those plants, and so all animal tissue is built of it. Humans, when they burn food, all animals, when they burn food, they burn it with oxygen, so it's just like you use in a fire, except it's a controlled burning biochemically. And so the oxygen and the food molecules they have are burned, and carbon dioxide is a byproduct. Carbon dioxide is produced by animals in burning their food and then inhaled by plants, which make it back into food. So there are three substances without which no life on Earth would be possible: water, oxygen, carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is the source of all carbon and all living things. And the idea that it's a pollutant is just a bad joke.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. I figured since we were talking about, you had mentioned your associate was the discovered carbon 14.
Well, we've done
I just thought I would ask you about carbon because it's the basis, as you know, for an entire new industrial complex of, you know, everything else, which I haven't heard you talk about, but I am familiar that you have been talking about it on a separate level. I don't want to diffuse this conversation, but I wanted, as a scientist, for you to articulate what carbon is and what carbon isn't.
You got it. I'll stay away from global warming.
Yeah, no problem. It's not a problem. I just don't want to mix the conversation. But is there anything else you'd like to say as a scientist about carbon dioxide?
Well, now you've opened it, right?
I can't help myself. Sure. We're here. We're at the juncture.
Well, one of our websites lists what 32,000 scientists want to say about it. We, because of this growing demonization of carbon dioxide, we became alarmed and decided that we should do something to help. And we studied the subject very carefully and wrote two review articles about it and circulated a petition among American scientists. The petition is to the U.S. government, and it says that there is no convincing scientific evidence that carbon dioxide or the burning of hydrocarbon fuels is harming the climate, and that, in fact, this extra production of carbon dioxide is good because it stimulates the growth of plants and animals. This is completely opposite to the government's point of view. Anyway, we circulated this petition among scientists in the United States, and 32,000 of our colleagues signed up, including a lot of famous people. This has been a terrible thorn in the side of those who want to build an anti-carbon industry, and most recently it was discussed at the presidential conference, news conference on Monday. The President Obama's news secretary, Mr. Gibbs, told the conference that Carol Browner at the EPA had thousands of scientists who agreed with the government's position. And one of the reporters said, well, but what about the 31,000 scientists that these guys in Oregon signed up that are against that position? So it's a political football.
My question to you is, when the average person looks out at the world and sees traditional pollution, like what you would see by the human eye, like stuff spewing out of oil companies or stuff spewing out of whatever other kind of companies,
sure,
plants, manufacturing plants, stuff spewing into the air, the average person is startled and upset because they know that something, we don't know what it is, some type of chemicals, synthetic chemicals or something is going into the atmosphere. Now, I've done two segments already on climate and weather, but There's so many factors and that have been left out of the entire plate of the climate and weather dialogue that it's preposterous. But my question to you is, how do you address the average person who says, look, I'm just committed that pollution stop. There are a lot of companies that do pollute and send polluting chemicals into the environment. Do you at least agree with that?
Oh, sure. I agree with them. I'm for stopping pollution, too. You know, tremendous strides have been made. There's always a problem because if your electricity coming out of your wall depends on burning coal, you have to be a little concerned about how fast you stop it, because if you shut off the coal plants, you have no electricity. On the other hand, you should work as hard as you can to stop the pollution produced by those plants. So I'm as probably as strong as you are for stopping real pollution. The problem is the carbon dioxide is a colorless gas. They've never seen that coming out of a plant because you can't see it, and it's absolutely required for life. You have to be careful about what you call as a pollutant. If carbon dioxide is a pollutant, water's a pollutant, and oxygen's a pollutant. Where do we stop? All chemicals are pollutants. You see, this is wrong. This is just taking advantage of ignorant people and telling them that basically not just that the air they breathe, they're being told that the air they breathe is being polluted. But in this case, you're saying that the very air is a pollutant. Because carbon dioxide, oxygen, and water are the molecules required for life, and they are the essential components of air. Carbon dioxide is simply not a pollutant. Now, what they've done is to say, yes, but it's increased a little, and that is causing global warming. But that, in fact, is not true. There's no evidence for that. It's a myth. So they're being fooled. And they're being fooled by people who just want to make a lot of money and get power over them, not by people who want to do them any good. Carbon dioxide is not something they can see. It's produced by everything. In fact, it's produced by them. I'm sitting in this office talking to you, and as a result, the carbon dioxide in this office is probably twice the concentration it is outside because I'm breathing it out all the time. And the trees outside are going to breathe it in and grow with it.
So it's everywhere.
Just because it's produced in the process of living, every living thing exhales it, and produced also in the process of making energy, doesn't make it a pollutant. The things you see belching out of a smokestack are things that none of us want to breathe, and I agree with great advances in technology to stop that.
I wanted to ask you a point I might make.
And yes. That is, you wouldn't have any of those smokestacks, at least from the coal-fired power plants, if the government hadn't stopped the development of nuclear power in this country, which doesn't produce any smoke.
You know what? I will tell you, and again, I'm one of these people that am scared of nuclear. I am. But I'm scared out of what I've heard about it, not what I know about it.
That's exactly right. And that's... everybody that's scared of it is because they've heard things about it that aren't true, but they don't know. You've heard that it causes terrible pollution, dangerous pollution. But in fact, it doesn't cause any pollution if you allow the plants to recycle the fuel. France makes all of its electricity with nuclear power and has no nuclear waste problem because they simply recycle the fuel.
Now, I didn't know that. That's very interesting.
And the Bush administration was in the process of making possible the building of a recycling plant in the United States. But the Obama administration canceled the plant, so it's not going to be built. Nuclear waste is simply a product of government regulation that prevents the recycling of the fuel. If we had a government law to prevent the recycling of pop cans, then we'd have a pop can pollution problem, too.
So, for example, images of Chernobyl, that's what I remember as a younger person.
Right.
Every time I think nuclear, I think of that meltdown, and then I panic.
Chernobyl, the Russians built a a poorly designed plant with no containment building and operated it improperly. So there was an accident. The accident killed about 30 people. It was a bad accident.
Right, but the radiation, there's 30 people would be...
No, radiation didn't kill anybody because it was so dilute. You've been told that it killed a lot of people and made them sick, but it didn't. It did kill people. There were tens of thousands of babies aborted in Europe because the press convinced their mothers that they would be damaged by the radiation. This was false. The radiation from Chernobyl, it is believed, it isn't certain because of sampling difficulties, but it is believed that a couple of hundred children in the area near the plant contracted thyroid cancer from it, and one of them died.
I think I heard that, too.
Yeah. This is possible. We're not sure because they started checking for thyroid cancer, and the Russians weren't checking very carefully for it beforehand. So we don't have a baseline,
sure.
But it's possible. Chernobyl was not a good thing. There's no chance whatever that any plant in the United States could ever have done that. Our most famous accident was Three Mile Island. Three Mile Island had a meltdown. You could have been standing at the gate of Three Mile Island during the entire accident, and you wouldn't have gotten any more radiation. You wouldn't have gotten as much radiation as you would have if you'd been standing there with a friend beside you, because the radiation coming from the isotopes in your friend's body was far more intense than the radiation coming from the plant. Three Mile Island killed no one. In fact, we've had 104 nuclear power plants operating in this country on average for 30 years, the average lifetime of those plants, and not one person has ever died as a result of that energy generation. And that can't be said for any other kind of energy generation at all. No member of the public and no member of the staffs of those plants. It's the safest, cleanest possible form of energy. But people have been, firstly, when they were propagandizing about it and stopping its development in the 70s, they were running... We almost lost Detroit, the China syndrome. They were telling people these plants could blow up like atomic bombs.
That's what I was told.
This is physically impossible. It's not a question of opinion. It can't. The materials in the plants cannot explode. It can't be done. It's like saying that dynamite can explode so the butter in your refrigerator can explode. I'm sorry, just because they're both nuclear...
Yes.
Everything is nuclear. Your body is made of atoms that are full of nuclei. You, in fact, emit radiation. The walls of the room you're in right now are emitting radiation.
And speaking of radiation, I just want to cut in here for a minute. Speaking of radiation and pollution, one of the things that very much upsets me about the whole climate, weather, quote, global warming scenario is that the ground of the new industrial and legal complex is based on this carbon scenario, this carbon story.
Well, that's what they want it to be.
Yes, yes, exactly. But wait, the thing that drives me crazy about it is that there is so much electromagnetic pollution, both with microwave stations, which are set up in droves, and cellular communications. If the average person knew the level of electromagnetic pollution that's in their body, their brain, their own electromagnetic system every day, they would be in shock. And yet this is not considered a pollution. And it's not even on the table as something that could be affecting people in their daily lives or altering weather.
Yeah, well, you need to, in each case of something that is produced, you have to balance the potential risks with the potential benefits. Nuclear power, for example, we were discussing that.
Yes.
Do you know how much money it has cost the American people not to have the nuclear power plants that were canceled because of the fear that was generated? Conservatively, it's $10 trillion worth of energy that was not generated because the plants weren't built. $10 trillion pays the whole national debt. A tiny part of $10 trillion would pay every mortgage in the country. We have this supposed huge financial crisis now, which is not only diminishing people's lives, but probably killing a lot of them because of the changes they have to make in their lives because of difficulties, the United States could use $10 trillion. And you have to ask whether a technology which, built properly in the United States, never killed a single human being, nor sickened a single human being, as far as we know, was worth should be suppressed, and the $10 trillion electricity it would have generated not made. In that case, the trade-off between the risk and the reward was ridiculous, but it was made because people were lied to about the risk. In each case of technology, you have to look at the risk versus the reward. You do that in medicine. Usually, medical procedures don't give you enough radiation to harm you. But if you were ill and needed to be continually scanned for something, let's say a cancer, you'd be getting perhaps more radiation than is good for you. On the other hand, they're trying to save your life, so the risk-reward is valuable. We get a lot of benefit from cell phones. We don't know too much quantitatively about the risks. But in each thing that we do, that's throughout life, everything we do is the risk-reward. You're going to get in your car probably and drive somewhere this week. But that's the most dangerous thing you do. 40,000 Americans are killed every year driving those things. But there's a risk versus a reward. You take the risk because of the quality that it adds to your life. In each case, you need to know, and what happens politically is opportunists who seek to gain power and money at your expense, or at the expense of the American people, go out and lie to them.
But now it's the global. It's the whole world.
Yeah, it's a big global business, and there are lots of people planning to make huge amounts of money and get lots of power, more political power, based on this thing, and the whole thing's a lie.
So how do scientists around the world, I've got to ask you this, because it's a consistent question I ask. How do scientists who know what you know about carbon, how can they hold back from everything that is known about carbon dioxide being a form of nourishment?
Here's what's happening. Firstly, I got a list of 32,000 that didn't hold back, okay? They put their names down as saying this thing's a bogus. But what's happening? There are most of them holding back. And take the United States. We have this little scandal over in England now, but the bigger scandal is that I don't know a single university where the scientists are not quieted down, we might say at the least, from speaking about this subject. All of these universities, all of our universities now, the science departments depend on huge government grants to do their work. When Obama came in, he increased that by 50%. Tens of billions of dollars a year are supporting scientific research in all of our universities that have science departments. Now, they're not all working on climate. Most of them aren't. But it doesn't do well to offend the government. Caltech, where Noah and I graduated, we're proud of it. It's a good institution full of fine scientists. But a few months ago, three of us who are alumni asked to give a seminar there on this subject. And the third one, Noah and I, and the third one was the last man to walk on the moon, Harrison Schmitt, who was the senator, walked on the moon and is one of the most famous graduates of Caltech. The three of us asked to give a seminar on this subject, and they wouldn't let us. Because Caltech gets half its money from the government, it doesn't want to talk about this. Just keep your head down. Don't say anything. You might offend somebody, and it might hurt our grants. So you have, throughout the American scientific establishment, the money, they used to be privately funded, but after World War II, this changed. And most scientists now work on government money. Now, this does not mean the scientist is dishonest. It doesn't mean he will, a few will, but most are honest men and women who will properly report their results and so forth and not impugning their integrity. They're just in positions where it's better to keep quiet because if you make waves, you or someone at your institution may not get the money he needs. because the government is pro-global warming. And this, when we were gathering our petition results, we got all these tens of thousands of signatures, but we were, if a scientist was in an academic institution where government money was being used, he was only one-fourth as likely to sign as if he was in private industry because of the dangers of expressing an opinion that is different from the government's opinion. This is one of the things that goes with socialism and government control. You don't have to just, you don't hand a guy cash and say, lie for me. You just don't bite the hand that feeds you, or you may not be fed. So this is the big problem. That's the major reason that the scientists are quiet. And you were talking earlier about the fact that we don't have government funding. If we had government funding and if we had done the work we did on global warming, we certainly wouldn't have government funding.
And
so we were able to make that petition and circulate it mostly because we don't have government funding. If we did, we wouldn't have a chance. We wouldn't have done it.
So this is really, you know how every breakdown and every problem and every obstruction is also synonymous with an opportunity?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that there's an opportunity at hand for a critical mass of scientists to take a stand and have faith and to act on that faith that what is theirs, will be guided to them, that opportunity will seek them, that the cause of funding doesn't always have to be government, that there are and will be private individuals and groups who will get behind pure, integrous work.
Yeah, well,
and if you
right.
don't believe that, and you're a scientist, then you will accept and digest the collusion efforts to obstruct your work.
Right. Now, understand what I said. I'm not suggesting that there are a lot of guys at Caltech who are dishonest in their work.
I understand.
They just don't speak up. It's like a...
No, I understand.
A friend of mine had a story about the Soviet Union and... I won't tell a Soviet joke. But anyway, the bottom is, line, you don't speak up. It's not in your best interest to do so. But you see, this...
But I can tell you one thing, Art. Art, one second.
You are speaking up to a certain extent.
Art, one second here.
Yeah.
I want to tell you something. I'm totally listening to what you're saying. I totally can get it. I can see it. I can feel it. And at the same time, what I have to tell you about is that there's something insidious about being in a position out of that kind of fear, right?
Mm-hmm. I know.
It's a survival fear of standing by in silence, and it's the silence. It is corrosive.
Yeah.
And I believe and I feel that the critical mass of silence is what starts and fuels tyranny. And so I appreciate what you're saying. Other scientists have said it, who I've talked with. And at the same time, you know, if people believe they're the only way to be funded is from the government, so I think the first thing is to release that belief because you're living proof that it can be done otherwise.
Yeah, well, you see, there's always a cost. Noah and I, when we were going to think about this petition 2 years ago, we were going to have to quit. It actually took us 6 months because we had to review the whole literature, write the review article, and circulate the petition. And before we did it, we looked at each other and said, do we have to do this? This is going to take us 6 months away from our research work and all the things we love and we're trying to accomplish. And we finally, what we really did was say, well, neither of us served in the military. I guess we owe it to our country. So we took 6 months off and did it as a public service. If you look me up in Wikipedia, you'll see the effects of that.
I already did look you up in Wikipedia, and I was pretty startled to see how somebody and groups made sure that you were villainized in Wikipedia.
Oh, if I believe the stuff I can read about myself on the internet, I'd be unwilling to have dinner with myself.
But I want to ask you about, you know, I used to hear a lot of good things about Wikipedia, but now that I know what can be done inside Wikipedia and how people's reputations can be impugned. And you can get anybody with no accountability coming in and telling any story that could sit on there for days, weeks, months, years.
Yeah. And several of our friends have told me they've tried to rectify the problem with us on Wikipedia. They can't. Any change they make is reversed in seconds. I don't think all of Wikipedia is polluted, but
I don't either.
When they target somebody, they make sure that the things that are put up there that are incorrect can't be changed.
And that's why I think that ultimately this is going to be a grand galactic test for many of us to test our faith.
Optimistic. Let me just interject something. Before the internet, we had a situation where the news media and our sources of information could suppress the truth. They could, if they didn't always, but sometimes if they wanted to push something that wasn't true, they simply did so by not advertising the truth, only advertising the myth. That was done in nuclear power in the 70s. But now it's different. The truth on the internet, the truth stands just as visible as the lie. You know that the internet is a vast amount of stuff being sent by everybody on Earth to everybody else. It's an enormous thing. But for the first time in human history, the truth stands on a level playing field with the lie. If there's a subject, you can go there and you can find all kinds of claims. Some of the claims are true, some of them are false. But at least the truth and the lie now compete on a level playing field. And I'm convinced that this is the best thing that's happened to us because on a level playing field, the truth will ultimately win.
Well, I will tell you that for 4 years, the United States radio stations were not interested in Kim Greenhouse and its rainmaking time because I was doing a show about true inquiry and discovery and interested in bringing in new knowledge to the public. And I cannot tell you how many stations I talked to of every kind, public, private, satellite, where they were just not interested. They were agenda-driven. They were obstructing the ability for new knowledge and discovery to get through. And so I just let go of it and said, you know what? I'll build my own network. I'll do my own show. I'll have the kind of conversation and discourse that can elevate and illuminate new knowledge and perspectives that are worthy of taking on and have meaningful dialogue where I don't have advertisers telling me what I can and can't talk about or who I can interview. The other day I went to interview another guest and I won't mention his name. And he went on my site and he said, so I see you've been interviewing global warming deniers. I said, what? What are you talking about? This is the kind of thing that would happen in a large radio station context where a station were telling me what I could and couldn't talk about or who I could and couldn't talk to. And immediately I was categorized by this person. And I thought, first of all, I'm about to spend my time, my energy, and my money illuminating your work. What does that have to do with what other shows I cover? But it's just interesting that the internet provides for this kind of open platform of expansiveness that other stations and other mediums don't allow for. So I agree with you. But it's interesting, the same pressure that the scientists feel about speaking out about their knowledge of carbon and science, I have already begun to feel the squeeze just by talking to people.
Right.
Just by talking to people.
That's right.
On my show, whatever it is. Or all of a sudden being very excited to be on my show, but they had somebody go in and listen to one of the shows, and apparently I'm this big denier, and the judgment is so profound. It's so politicized, but it's very, very interesting that we live at this time of great opportunity too, really great opportunity, and an exciting field of new discoveries, a new universe of knowledge really is ready to bust through. And the questions are going to be how we, in a parallel universe, start to get it going, really let it out. So I really appreciate you coming on and introducing your work regarding metabolites and the revolutionizing of the 21st century medical paradigm and consumer-based diagnostics using the internet. I appreciate all that you've talked about in the last part of this interview, a little bit about your homeschooling curriculum, and elucidating more about the world in the realm of carbon. And I just thank you very much. If there's anything else you'd like to say, you're welcome to say it.
No, but thank you very much. Thank you for your interest in our work, and thanks for this opportunity to talk to you.
And I want to be available to talk to you about anything else that comes up. And thank you very much, Dr. Art Robinson, for being our guest on It's Rainmaking Time. Many blessings to you, sir.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.